Om Shri Sai Ram. Humble pranams at the lotus feet of Bhagwan Baba. The Prashanti Digital Studio, in collaboration with Radio Sai, is pleased to offer Volume 2 of our CD set, Veda Pushpanjali.
Devotees coming to Prashanti Nilayam must have noticed that in the olden days, no important function or divine discourse started without a Vedic chant first. Devotees would have also seen extensive chanting of the Vedas during the Dasara celebrations. More recently, Veda chanting has become a regular part of the darshan, with Swami sitting in his chair and listening to the sonorous chants for extended periods, often lost in bliss.
Well, what exactly are these chants? What do they mean? Why does Swami seem to attach so much importance to them? Our CD set, Veda Pushpanjali, seeks to provide answers to many of these questions that often arise in the minds of devotees, especially those unfamiliar with the ancient scriptures of India.
In Volume 1 of this series, we offered a general introduction to the Vedas and then went on to present the famous Taittiriya Upanishad. In the present volume, we offer the equally famous Purusha Suktam, heard almost every day in Prashanti Nilayam during darshan time.
Very simply said, the word Suktam means a good word. Thus, Purusha Suktam means in praise of Purusha. That is what this wonderful hymn with 24 stanzas is all about. This, of course, raises the question, who exactly is this Purusha and why are his praises being sung? Before we consider these points, a few words about the Vedas so that the Purusha Suktam gets properly placed in its context.
Briefly, the Vedas are the fountainhead of ancient Indian scriptures. This is what Swami says about the Vedas. The Vedas are the most ancient among the world's scriptures. They are a vast storehouse of wisdom. The Vedas are immeasurable, unrivaled, and filled with bliss. The Vedas basically consist of hymns that have been compiled and categorized in a structured manner. Skipping the details, we may note that there are four basic Vedas: the Rig Veda, the Samaveda, the Yajurveda, and the Atharvana Veda. Further, each Veda has three portions. These are the Samhitas, the Brahmanas, and the Aranyakas.
The Samhita portion basically consists of mantras or sacred verses organized in a systematic manner. It is the chant of these Vedic mantras that is normally heard even in Prashanti Nilayam. Thus it is that the Samhita portion of the Vedas are better known than the other portions. In a sense, the Samhitas form the core of the Vedas.
The Brahmanas are texts that serve as working manuals, spelling out how the various Vedic rites and rituals ought to be performed. Turning next to the Aranyakas, this word is derived from the word Aranya, meaning forest. Aranyakas are the texts that were studied by seekers in ancient times who withdrew into the forest in order to contemplate and meditate in solitude. Understandably, the Aranyakas tend to be the most philosophical part of the Vedas. The famous Upanishads come at the end of the Aranyakas.
Regarding the role that the Vedas play in human development, Swami has this to say: the Vedas teach man his duties from birth to death. They describe his rights and responsibilities in all stages of life, as a student, a householder, recluse, and monk. With these preliminary remarks, we now turn to Purusha Suktam proper. As already remarked, it is in praise of Purusha. Now who is this Purusha? He is none other than the Supreme Lord, who it turns out is known by many names. In this particular suktam, the term Purusha is the one that is most often used.
At this point, we need to remind ourselves of something that Swami often draws our attention to, namely, that there is only one God and that He is omnipresent. The point being made is far from trivial. Driven by misconceptions and inadequate understanding, many so-called religious scholars spend a lot of time arguing whether the God worshipped by Christians is the same as the God worshipped by Hindus or Muslims or Jews or whatever. All such debates are meaningless and a complete waste of time, for there is only one God, though different people may choose to call this one God by different names. That is why Swami often quotes the Vedas to say, "Truth is one, though scholars refer to it by many names."
In passing, it is also useful at this juncture to dispose of an argument that is often heard from immature people who allege that Hinduism is riddled with gods, in fact too many of them. Actually, there is only one God who is being given many names and forms to. If devotees find it convenient to picture the Lord in their mind's eye in a particular way, then so be it. However, in Hinduism as it is referred to, there is no rigidity. Instead, there is perfect democracy and perfect freedom of choice too. However, though devotees may choose to worship God via various names and forms, that in itself does not rule away the fact that God is really one and is omnipresent.
By the way, it is also pertinent to make a couple of comments on what is usually referred to as Hinduism. Strange as it may sound, where Hindus are concerned, there is actually no formally defined Hinduism. The word Hinduism gained currency after the entry of the British into India. As far as the so-called Hindus are concerned, what they live by is Sanatana Dharma, which is all about God, man, and the duty of the latter to the former. The frills and details of procedure are not considered so important for real seekers, and what one is expected to seek is the identity of the individual soul with the cosmic soul or God. In this sense, ancient Indian philosophy goes far beyond what one encounters in other systems of philosophy. All that is discussed in the Vedas, and that is what makes them unique.
Getting back to our main point, agreed that God is one and that He is omnipresent. The question then arises, how exactly is He present in the universe of which we are a part? If God is present everywhere in the universe, is He in us too? These are the important spiritual and philosophical questions, the answers to which are scattered across the Vedas. And all these answers have been reinforced by Swami in His earlier avatar as Krishna when He taught the Bhagavad Gita to Arjuna.
As Krishna explains to Arjuna, in the ultimate analysis, God is formless, absolute, and beyond both space as well as time. Purusha is one name for this formless and abstract God. There are of course many other names like Paramatma, Brahman, Parabrahman, and so on. Purusha is infinite, timeless, eternal, etc. Question: what is the relationship between Purusha, or this absolute Lord Supreme, and the universe? The answer is as follows. In brief, the eternal Lord chose for reasons of his own, to project himself into lower dimensions, and it is this projection that manifests to us as the universe. As Swami describes it, I separated myself from myself so that I could love myself. Sounds mysterious, does it not? But the Purusha Suktam offers some insight. We shall consider that a little later.
At this point, we note the following important statement. At the very highest level, the Lord exists in an absolute state, a state that is truly infinite and totally beyond our comprehension and our vocabulary as well. The Vedas themselves declare so. This is not surprising, since our experiences and thoughts are substantially shaped by space and time, which, so to say, form the boundaries of the physical universe of which we all are a part. So unless we try to break away from these limitations, and it turns out that we actually can, we cannot even have the faintest idea of the Absolute.
The Lord Supreme, namely Purusha, who lives in his eternal abode, has also projected himself into the finite universe to appear in various forms. In this sense, he also pervades the universe. When Swami says, I am in you, above you, below you, ahead of you, behind you, etc., it is not a simple or trivial statement. It is a profound truth echoed in the Vedas and the Bhagavad Gita. Though Swami often makes his remark in a seemingly casual manner, especially during interviews.
Thus, God is both above creation and also below it. Well, above creation, he is in an absolute state. In what manner is he present below creation? The Lord, in his avatar as Krishna, has clearly explained that. Lord Krishna says that in creation, God is unmanifest as well as manifest. The manifest aspect is easier to understand. In brief, it means that everything that is a part of the physical universe is God and nothing but God. Thus, wind is God, the tree is God, mountain is God, river is God, crow is God, vulture is God, and so on. You name it and it is God. Sounds extraordinary, does it not? Yet, if we think about it carefully, we cannot escape that conclusion.
Hardcore non-believers of today would shake their heads at all this and smile, perhaps condescendingly. What nonsense, they would exclaim. How can wind be God? Let us hear what Swami has to say about the wind. He sometimes asks in his discourses, has man made any fan that can blow as fiercely as a typhoon or a hurricane? How many of us realize that during a typhoon, wind speeds touch as high a figure as 250 kilometers per hour? Yes, 250 kilometers per hour. Do you know that a Category 4 hurricane, and these do sweep across the Atlantic from time to time, is as big as the state of Texas, and that it not only brings nearly half a meter of rain, but even at the periphery has a wind speed touching about 60 kilometers per hour. As Swami asks, has man made a blower that can generate that kind of air speeds, and that too over such vast areas?
Let us now swing to the other extreme and consider the crow. The ancients in India revered the crow. They were not crazy, but deeply appreciative of the fine balance in God's extraordinary master plan. How many realize that the unimpressive and somewhat ugly looking crow is actually nature's scavenger? you throw perishables and the crow comes from somewhere to eat it all. The ancient Indians revered the crow because they saw God in the crow coming to their help.
If we look carefully, every little thing in nature, right from the plankton upwards, plays a delicate role in preserving the integrity and balance of nature. Take the fish. As Swami says, the fish clean up the waters, including the great oceans. But what does man do? First, he pollutes the waters, and then he destroys the fish stock, almost en masse.
So if we choose to think about all this carefully and objectively, it should be abundantly clear that nature does have a carefully crafted master plan in which there are many players, big and small, each with its own unique role to play. We may not understand all of it, but that does not mean that the master plan does not exist. The non-believer might perhaps reluctantly concede that there is possibly some kind of a plan, but at the same time argue that the existence of a plan does not mean that there is a guiding spirit behind it. The ancients of India had no use for such evasive and meaningless arguments. They freely accepted, and with much joy too, that there was a Lord Supreme, and that not even an atom could move without His grace or He willing it. Mahatma Gandhiji once said, "There is an indefinable, mysterious power that pervades everything. I feel it, though I cannot see it." Gandhiji was merely echoing the sentiments of the people of the Vedic generation, passed on since then, right down to these modern times.
In a nutshell, the Vedas loudly proclaim that God is everywhere and in everything, from the tiny ant to the galaxies. This, incidentally, is a phrase that Swami often quotes. In other words, God is present everywhere in the manifest or the material world. But what about the unmanifest presence of God in creation? That also is not difficult to understand, at least in principle.
Just consider what we normally refer to as life. All of us readily understand what life means. We know when life is present and when it is absent. Yet, no one is really able to give a precise and scientific definition of life. Scientists who are non-believers carefully dodge this question. At the same time, even a scientist who proudly proclaims that he is an atheist just cannot deny that there is a thing called life. And this thing called life is absolutely subtle and unmanifest.
So is the mind. It too is both subtle and unmanifest. Everyone knows that there is a thing called the mind. But who has seen the mind? We tacitly assume that the mind exists within the human, but where exactly is it? We know where the heart is, where the liver is, and so on. But the mind, can anyone say for sure? And yet, exists it surely does.
So the long and short of it all is that in the universe, or if we prefer to call it as just creation, there is the manifest aspect of God and also the unmanifest aspect of God. The Purusha Suktam draws attention to all this, as did Lord Krishna later, with much clarity, we might add. Putting everything together, we have the following picture. There is above everything else the absolute level. God in His eternal and formal aspect is ever present at this, the highest level. When Lord Supreme brings the universe into existence, He does so essentially by projecting Himself. Thanks to this projection, the universe too has bits and pieces of His glory and power, only a tiny fraction in fact. but even that dazzles enormously. In the universe, the Lord is immanent in material entities, both insentient and sentient. This is the immanent presence of God, as some scholars describe it. In creation, the Lord also has an unmanifest presence. This is what scholars describe as the transcendental presence of the Lord in the universe, that is to say, a subtle presence which is transcending material entities. God is thus also present in subtle forms, such as the life force and the mind. This life force is what is referred to as prana in Vedic literature, and devotees might have heard this word occurring many times in Vedic chants. The ancients paid obeisance to the life force, for it is nothing but Lord unmanifest in the universe.
What Purusha Suktam does is to not only crisply call attention to all this, but also paint an allegorical and poetic picture of evolution itself. To put it in slightly different words, the Purusha Suktam gives a poetic description of God, man, the universe, and the relationship between all these three. We shall discuss the evolutionary aspect later, when we consider the meaning of the various stanzas. For the present, as we get ready to listen to the glorious chants, we would like to say the following. As in Volume 1, we shall first offer a slow chant of every single stanza. After the stanza is chanted, the meaning would be given, followed by additional comments where required. Pay careful attention to the references to all the three aspects of the Lord: the immanent, the transcendental, and the absolute. The description of creation is largely poetic and may not fit in with what modern science has revealed. At the same time, there is an aspect that modern science has fully vindicated that we shall take up when we offer an overview. Note also how the theme of sacrifice is skillfully woven into the text of adoration. This is an important aspect of Purusha Suktam that merits close attention. The Lord creates and dissolves the universe at His will. Universes come and go like passing clouds. Universes may come and go, but the Lord is forever, for He is eternal. The universe is a projection of the Lord, no doubt, but that does not mean that when He so projects Himself, a part of Him flows out into lower dimensions and His quantum at the absolute level gets diminished. Nothing can diminish infinity, and that, incidentally, is one way in which the concept of infinity is taught to students of mathematics. Infinity minus infinity remains infinity.
By the way, though the Purusha Suktam is supposed to be a part of the Rig Veda, it finds a place in other Vedas too. Moreover, it is chanted frequently, especially during various rituals.
We think we have said enough for a starter. And now, without any further ado, on to the chants proper.